plate a potential nugget.
Vinay, you speak about how he quickly changed his opinion. I'm curious about the notion of intellectual agility. You know, how leaders have strong views, but when they see data saying something else, they're very quickly, they're able to shift their beliefs. So talk to us about what gave that agility to Narasimha Rao.
Well, firstly, there are plenty of examples of this. The most famous one is his views on economic reforms. It was one of the few posts he hadn't held. You know, he'd never been industry minister before he became prime minister. He'd never been minister of finance. That was one area he didn't know very well. To the extent he knew it, he was an Indira Gandhi style protectionist. You know, and, you know, when confronted with a change in evidence, you know, when confronted with the fact that, you know, the Indian economy was simply not working, we had a balance of payment crisis, when he became prime minister in June 91, he changes his mind in a couple of days. And what is remarkable is once he changes his mind, he has this ability to execute, right? To implement. I mean, in India is full of ideas. You know, Narasimha Rao's remarkable ability is, and this is underrated because when people think of him as intellectually agile, as being a scholar, they forget the fact that he was tactically agile too. He knew how to get things done, right? He would have an idea, he would have a view, but he also knew the art of the possible. And I think that this agility, both these were a kind of jugalbandi. They worked hand in hand. That he could change his mind when it came to ideas, and he could also constantly refine implementation of those ideas, right? Let's take, you know, the classic example of Air India, right? Initially, he believed that Air India, that airline sector in India should be a national sector. You should not allow private competition, and you should certainly not allow foreign money. But, you know, he changes his mind in the early 90s, and he realizes that, you know, we need private competition when it came to airlines. Indian airlines alone just won't do. Right, so there was, he definitely had the ability when faced with data to change his mind. He also had the intellect, the agility when it came to implementation, which is what I call fox, mouse, and lion. Right, he realized that you needed private competition, so he allowed Jet Airways, Damania, East-West Airlines. Jet Airways, I think, takes off in 93. And today, again, you know, correct me on the data, but you know, 80-90% of domestic travelers don't travel on Indian Air India. They travel on on Indigo, on Go Airways. So Narasimha Rao's bet worked, right? At the same time, Narasimha Rao had the intellect or the, let's say, the implementation agility to realize that, you know, if he went too far and he privatized Air India at that time, the unions would protest hugely and his entire liberalization agenda would fall because he was a very weak prime minister. So he publicly swore that not a single Indian Airlines or Air India employee would lose his or her job as a result of privatization. That's what exactly what he did. Right? So the unions were happy because they weren't getting fired. He created things like VRS, but the unions were happy as well as the consumers were happy. But Narasimha Rao was smart enough to realize that you can't keep hiring in Air India and Indian Airlines if it isn't making profit. So if you just look at the data, hiring into Indian Airlines and Air India and other PSUs begins to freeze after Narasimha Rao comes to power. Because Narasimha Rao realizes that those who haven't yet got jobs aren't going to protest against him. So I think that there was an intellectual agility of the man, his ability to frequently change his mind when confronted with data. There was also an implementational agility. And Narasimha Rao's genius was both ideas and implementation came naturally to him. And that's what makes him really rare.
Very interesting. And I want to pick up on the three sort of animals used to sort of make the point, lion, fox, mouse. So let's double click on that. Talk to us about what you have in mind when you say that. But more importantly, how does Narasimha Rao exercise his judgment to figure out what to be when?
That's very hard to answer, right? That when do you know, you know, I mean, ask yourself this question, right? Like, you know, anyone listening to this podcast would frequently be in situations where you have to play lion, right? You have to be aggressive and you have to play to win, right? You know, slightly smarter ones who are listening to this podcast would also know that, you know, sometimes you have to lose. You know, sometimes, you know, the American phrase, right? Do I want to die on this hill? Like, some battles are not worth fighting because you may win the battle, you may lose the war, right? And sometimes you have to lie, you have to cheat, right? You can't say what you want to say. Narasimha's ability was to get both timing and circumstance very, very right, you know, and it's very hard to push that into a set of transferable skills because, you know, that's why judgment is so precious. But to give you just one example of that, India opening up to Israel, right? Just one example of that. Now, since the mid-80s, it was pretty clear that India had to move away from the Soviet Union towards the United States. It was clear that the Soviet model of the economy was not really working. Rajiv Gandhi was trying to, make an outreach towards Washington, D.C. It didn't really go the way he wanted to go. When Narasimha Rao becomes prime minister, he is told that, look, you know, the Berlin Wall has fallen. America is a lone superpower and we were on the wrong side of the Cold War. So we have to make an overture to Washington, D.C., right? And Narasimha Rao is also told by his IFS officers, his diplomats, that the road to Washington, D.C. runs through Tel Aviv. That India currently doesn't have diplomatic relations with Israel for a variety of reasons. We need to have diplomatic relations with Israel as a signal to America that now we are with America. Now, this was a domestic political hot potato, right? Because there was a feeling in India that Muslims might object. There was a feeling in India that, for most of India's independence, we had supported the Palestinian cause. So it was a sensitive issue, opening up to Israel, having full ambassadorial relations. What does Narasimha Rao do? He invites in Jan 92, Yasser Arafat, the head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, as chief guest to India. He hugs him. He tells his cabinet secretary, Naresh Chandra, to spread that photograph. The message is India is not deserting its Palestinian allies. In private, however, Narasimha Rao tells Yasser Arafat that, look, you are talking to the Israelis, what would ultimately culminate in the Oslo Accords of 93. If you want us to lobby the Israelis on your behalf, we have to have an ambassador. And Yasser Arafat, who's as much wily as Narasimha Rao, publicly states in Delhi that exchange of ambassadors is a sovereign question and we won't interfere with what our brother India does. Narasimha Rao immediately announces full diplomatic relations with Israel, goes to parliament and says publicly, with the blessings of my brother Yasser Arafat, I'm sending an ambassador to Israel, right? That is timing, right? It's understanding political context, understanding the different stakeholders, right? And getting the sequence exactly right. And contrast that to someone like Rajiv Gandhi, who came to power in 1984-85 with the largest mandate any prime minister has got in India. He actually tried in 85-86 to open up to Israel and he failed. So just power alone, just mandate alone is insufficient if you don't understand timing, if you don't understand your opponents. And that was Narasimha Rao's genius.
So just picking up on that, Vinay, one of the themes that comes through very clearly in the book as a attribute of Narasimha Rao is driving change under extreme constraints. Two terms before and four terms after him lasted less than a year. So it's fascinating that he was able to last a full term, but much more than that, was able to push through path-breaking reforms. So again, as we think about him being able to drive change under these constraints, are there themes that come out which are worth talking about in terms of what he did well to manage the sort of the slender context with the heaviness of the stuff that he was pushing through?
Well, this is the heart of the book, right? The central question of the book is, how did a man so weak achieve so much change? So it's not just that he was running a minority government. His own party hated him. He had to report to Sonia Gandhi, right? And the crisis that India had, from secession issues in Assam, Punjab and Kashmir, to our balance of payment crisis, to the fall of the Soviet Union, to Rajiv Gandhi's assassination. So here's a man with very little power, and Narasimha Rao also was, had famously the charisma of a dead fish. He was a really boring guy. So a man with very little charisma, right? Very little raw political power, very little mandate, and facing an inbox from hell, made this kind of change, right? And that's really the heart of the book. And I push at it again and again. I think one, and I could give many examples of it, but I think a core feature of why Narasimha Rao was successful was that instead of focusing on what needed to be done, he focused on how it should be done. And I think that's very important. That the what question, what needs to be done, presumes you have a mandate, presumes you have the ability to get things done. The first question you should ask as a leader is, where do you get your power from? How much power do you have? If you want to do X, can you do X, right? Or can you do only X minus 1? In which case you should ab initio begin by trying to do X minus 1 because that's the maximum you can do. I think that was Narasimha Rao's genius, that he had no illusions that he was a weak prime minister. He wasn't easily flattered by, the normal chamchas around you who make all politicians think they're Alexander the Great. He knew he was not charismatic. He knew people didn't like him. He knew he was a fill-in for the Nehru Gandhis because Rajiv had died. And he relentlessly focused on how you should get things done, right? Second is he had this ability to play one constraint against the other. So he had a lot of people who didn't like him. So he spent a lot of time making sure that those who didn't like him were busy fighting each other, right? To give one classic example, the two main opposition parties he had to deal with were the left and the BJP, right? And he just, you know, and if the two of them had voted together in any no confidence motion, Narasimha Rao would have been toast. He would have to resign immediately. So Narasimha Rao spent a lot of energy making sure that these two constraints, the BJP and the communists, were always fighting with each other, right? So, for example, he would, go and tell, when the communists would come in to him and complain about liberalization, one communist MP told me this, Narasimha Rao said, forget about liberalization, think of Babri Masjid. It's communalism that is the problem today. We need to focus on secularism, and on this, you have to be on my side. He does this instinctively, it's remarkable, right?
It's the fox, right?
It's the fox, you know, 100%, right? And think about what that achieves, right? Immediately after the demolition of Babri Masjid, when everyone is baying for Narasimha Rao's blood, where everybody on India thinks that his political career has ended, what does he do? He opens private licenses for banks, right? That's what he does soon after Babri Masjid, right? Now, in India, giving private licenses for new banks is a highly political subject, right? Remember that Indira Gandhi's nationalization, the famous socialist phase, began with the nationalization of private banks, right? It was nationalized once in the late 1960s and a second time in 1980. So giving banks licenses to new banks, which are today very famous, ICICI, HDFC, for example, is a politically loaded subject. So when does Narasimha Rao pick the time to do it? Immediately after demolition of Babri Masjid, when the communists, when the socialists within his own party are rallying around him against the onslaught of the communal BJP, right? That's Narasimha Rao's ability to play constraint against each other, but at the same time being deeply aware of the fact that it's very important to focus on how to do things in India, not what to do.
Very, very interesting.
It's indeed fascinating to see the combination of intellectual agility coupled with implementation dexterity in the way Narasimha Rao went about driving change, as Vinay points out. Marrying the knowledge of what is required with the art of what is possible, as Vinay points out, is a unique skill indeed. In leadership literature, I see a lot of commentary around learning agility, but much less around agility in our beliefs, our ability to continuously revisit our assumptions and change our worldview while presented with new data, and that's a unique skill indeed. I also see much less commentary around the notion of driving change and nuanced implementation in the context of a web of stakeholders with multiple diverging agendas around you. As we move to a world where things will have to get done through complex ecosystems, these skills are going to be of greater and greater premium. As Vinay says, the jugalbandi between the intellectual agility and the implementation dexterity is going to become more and more critical in a world that's getting more and more VUCA with each passing day. Thank you for listening. If you're new to the podcast and want to get a sense of the nature of the content that's covered, you might want to go to YouTube and type Play to Potential Highlights from 2017. There I've tried to capture the key takeaways from my various conversations last year with leaders across disciplines. If you want to listen offline, say during a car ride home or during airplane travel, you could also access the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Savan, and several other podcast apps. In fact, Google has also recently launched an app for podcast listening on Android platforms. If you went to playtopotential.com, you could also have the opportunity to listen to multiple voices curated by topic. To give you a sense, one of the playlists is inflection points. These are points in time where the notion of what got you here won't get you there applies in a pretty profound way. If you find the content purposeful, please go to iTunes, rate the show, and share a review. It will help others discover it. Thank you for listening.